There's a burden to understand the mystery of suffering, the issue of it. Now, we all understand it, you know, when it's about the world. We can understand. People unconverted, people of a different religion, you know, people in the Shintoism, the Buddhism, the Muslims, the this or that. We say, okay, we understand that because that's where suffering happens. But this might shock us when we have a Psalm of David that goes like this, Psalm 31, verse 5, beginning in verse 5. Into your hand I commit my spirit. Remember those words. Jesus said that, you remember. Into your hand I commit my spirit, something like that. You have ransomed me, O eternal God of truth. I hate those who regard vain idols, but I trust in the eternal. I will rejoice and be glad in your loving kindness because you have seen my affliction. You have known the troubles of my soul. Here's King David, a man after God's own heart, a man who worships God, a man who wrote many psalms, but he had troubles. And you have not given me over into the hand of the enemy. You have set my feet in a large place. Verse 9, be gracious to me, O eternal, for I am in distress. My eye is wasted away from grief. My soul and my body also wasted away from grief. For my life is spent with sorrow and my years with sighing. My strength has failed because of my iniquity and my body has wasted away. Because of all my adversaries, I have become a reproach, especially to my neighbors, and an object of dread to my acquaintances. Those who see me in the street flee from me. I'm forgotten as a dead man. Out of mind, I'm like a broken vessel. I mean, talk about depressing, a very low. I mean, this is suffering. This is mental. So there are many kinds of suffering. We'll talk about that. And how about Jesus at the end of his life, you know, and as he's facing the cross, he says in John chapter 12 and verse 27, now my soul has become troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. Save me from this hour. But for this purpose, I came into the world. Now think long and hard with me about the mysteries of life and death, about love and suffering, about hope and misery, right? About wonderful blessings and sometimes cursings. You remember the story, I mean, remember the account in the book of Matthew. It's in the book of Matthew chapter 4. And Jesus is being tempted of the devil, you know, first was the bread, and then why don't you jump down from here, his angels will give you charge. But then later on, in Matthew chapter 4, you're dropping down to verse 8, here's what, again, the devil took him to a very high mountain, and he showed him, there had to be a pretty high mountain, all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. Marching bands, all the troops, all the strengths, all the chariots, all the horses, all the pageantry, all the good things. And he said to him, all these things I'll give to you if you will fall down and worship me. Now here's the world. All the glory. Come on, take it. Here's the glory. You can have it if you fall down and worship me. I'll be your boss. You worship me. You obey me. You serve me. You do what I want. And of course, you know what Jesus said. Get behind me. Get out of here. You know, you shall worship the eternal your God, and him only shall you serve. But if you looked over the world, suppose you were taken up to a pretty high place, you could see the world as Jesus would see it. And he did see it. He saw other things beside the glory of the kingdoms, didn't he? How about the millions of human beings, herded and crammed together in many cases? Yes, even the joyful and the sorrowful. Men dying, people being born, some praying, others cursing, women laughing, others weeping. All these heaped together, huddled together, masses, people all over the world. And that's what you see. It's not just the glory of the kingdoms. It's the masses, their sicknesses, their glories, their sports, their deaths, their hospitals, their sick, their lame, their this and so on. Now, this God is up here. Satan is like, he said, let's look it over. Here it is. Does God just sit above it all, uncaring? Is God just sitting up there doing nothing about it? How many troubled people are there today? How many people are suffering today? And yet for many people, God seems so remote, so high above the earth and its turmoil and its confusion and its sufferings and its darknesses, and its that we have so many of these unresolved questions that are crying out for answers. There are critics of Christianity, you know. They say that it's absurd. It's an absurd thought to think that the Christian God, that God takes an interest in human beings. That's stupid. That's silly. He doesn't. He could care less. That's what they say, if there is a God at all. In ancient Greek drama, Euripides talked about the Trojan woman. He said he drew this picture of the queen. Her name was Hecuba. She was brokenhearted and widowed and childless, and with all the world in ruins around her. While, he says, while the gods of the Olympus are too absorbed in other things to hear her bitter cry or even to notice her where she lies prostrate before them in the dust. This is the Greek tragedy, the Greek play. The gods are too busy to notice you. Could God say that? Could our God say, I just sit above it all, I'm alone in the stars, and I don't have anything to do with it? Is God like that? From the suffering death of Rachel, weeping for her children, when the kids were killed during the reign of Herod, to the actual suffering and death of Jesus Christ on the cross, is God just unconcerned? There are a lot of troubles, a lot of forms of troubles in the world. Lots of forms of suffering. There's physical suffering, which we know. There's mental suffering. There are people who are just tormented mentally, day and night. Obsesses, fears, this and that. Terrible thoughts, thoughts that haunt them so. I talked to a woman who said she likes to cut herself because in cutting herself, she doesn't feel the pain up here. I had another client who liked to bang her head on the wall. Banged her head on the wall until it was swollen and hurt so bad, but it relieved the pain from inside her mind. A lot of challenges, emotional, mental, spiritual. And the challenges which we collect, all these challenges are often a challenge to faith, because we crave to understand and we need some light to flash into the darkness of this understanding. Certainly no one who takes life seriously can escape the necessity of confronting the problem of suffering or coming to terms with it. And we don't want to use a lot of stock phrases, there's a nobility in pain. And it's an uplifting influence of suffering. And, these are good. Or the little stock phrase, well, consider how good this is for your character, Or would you try to heal somebody with it? Well, take courage. It might have been worse. That's what a lot of people say that. Or don't worry. I know you're sick now. I know that, but death may not happen to you right away, or this may not turn out to be as bad as you think. And we give all these little platitudes. When we look at history, when we see where suffering comes from. Suffering is all over the world. It has been. It's part of the world. There's joys. There are picnics today. There are people at the beach today. There are people having fun today. There are people going to sports events today. There are people having wonderful picnics, family dinners, and so on. And it's just wonderful today. But there are also people not feeling well. You know, if you look at history, you see these unspeakable sufferings of war, the horrors of war, the desecrated and defiled, monstrous iniquities and barbarity and persecution and intolerance that war brings. It is foul. So war shows us history. History shows us suffering. Life shows us suffering. Walk through any hospital, walk through any old folks' home or nursing homes, and you'll see suffering. And we ask the question, how come babies are born blind, some babies, or deaf, or brain damaged? And some of them, why do the innocent suffer? Why do innocent suffer? Why are there slums? Why is nature sometimes violent? Tornado comes on and it kills people in the house. It kills little children. You know, a doubter might say to his wife, you know, let's say, you know, if you're a religious wife and you have a skeptical husband, he might say, well, you know, there can't be a God, because in your heart, you must know it. You're a wise woman, he says. You read and you think. Well, then think, then ask yourself, how can there be a God and life be as it is? If there is one, he ought to be ashamed of himself. That's all I can say, the skeptical husband would say. So life forces us to question. He throws us this question upon us. Our own experience forces it on us, because we've all seen suffering and pain to some degree. Trouble brings many lives face to face with a spiritual crisis, a real threat. Now, as I say, the answer to the problem of suffering is not easy, but it needs to be somewhat clear. Suffering, in a sense, is a worse problem for the believer, you know? Now, you and I, we could say, okay, out there in the world, we know why they're suffering, because they don't believe like we do. But when I read the lists of faithful brethren, faithful women, faithful men, people who die in the church after suffering, after pain and suffering and agony and these things, then we ask this question, how about our faith? Suffering is a worse problem for the believer because we believe that God is love and that God's all-powerful. You see, now, for the guy who says there's no God, suffering's no problem. After all, we're all just born out of, you know, the slime of the earth. We came out of, you know, just, you know, lightning struck and this slime sparked of life and the amoebas. And after millions and billions and trillions of years, we became us. Was, oh, what do you expect? There's got to be some suffering. Well, who cares? I mean, this is there since there's no God. There's who cares about suffering? So the unbeliever, the skeptic, the atheist, has no problem with suffering. That's just the way life is. He accepts it. But for the believer, it is a burden. And let's face it, when you believe in Christianity the way we do in the Bible, Christianity often does not solve the problem of suffering. It heightens the problem of suffering and accentuates it. Because what do? When someone's that we pray about it, we think about it, we're constantly praying. So we often accentuate and heighten the problem of suffering. Now again, for the atheist, it's not hard to explain that there's so much suffering in the world. But for us, especially in the church, how do we explain suffering of God's people? How do we explain suffering of people who love God, who want God? That is the... Now, I submit to you that the unbeliever has a problem with this, okay? He's an unbeliever. Here's the problem he has. He doesn't have a problem with the things that are evil and bad in the world. That's just the way it is. I mean, after all, we just grew out of slime. So what he has a problem with is love and care and faith. And why would a person die for another? Why would somebody be so ethical to stand for what is right in the face of suffering? Why would somebody give his life for a principle, for a religion, for a truth that he believed in so desperately? That's the problem for the unbeliever. He can't explain these high ethical, wonderful standards that people live by. He can't explain that because that doesn't make sense to him. We got to get rid of two erroneous reasons for suffering. First, we got to reject the idea that all suffering comes from God. Now, I think most of us rejected that, right? You do not believe that God is the author of all suffering. He may let it happen, but he doesn't come from him. And we must equally get away from and reject the doctrine, the teaching that all suffering is the result of sin. Because remember, we went through the book of Job. And all his friends thought he sinned, and that's why he's suffering. But you can suffer not from sin. You know, we have a thing called gravity, right? If I have this pencil and I drop it, it falls down and hits the stand. Gravity may mean the death of a child who crawls up high and falls off a tree. Or the crash of an airplane. Or the result of all kinds of accidents, deaths. So gravity, just the fact that we have gravity, can result in suffering. But remember this, without gravitation, you couldn't walk along the street. You walk safely. You could not travel in a train. You could not launch a ship. You could not span a river with a bridge. You could not, we could not have bridges. We couldn't live as we do without gravity. Without gravity, you'd be floating up, banging your head on the ceiling. You know, you have gravity. Gravity is necessary. But gravity can cause troubles, suffering. We're all shocked when a house catches fire and little children or other people are trapped in it. We hear deaths from fires all kinds of times. And, you know, fire, this property gives out such heat. It can be the destruction of people. But then again, where would we be without fire? If we had no fire, we wouldn't have heat. We wouldn't have the ability to have what we have. Fire is a great friend. It's used to melt things. It's used for tools. It's used to make things. Fire, a very important factor. And yet, fire can be destructive. You see, you can't have it both ways. You can't have the benefits of fire without the liabilities of fire. Earthquakes, volcanoes. The earth is rumbling underneath us right now. Earth is rumbling. There's movement of these big shells. And that keeps things healthy for us. Earthquakes. Sometimes it moves big and things are shattered. Volcanoes erupt. And what do we have? Destruction. But at the same time, without it's working beneath the earth's surface, and it keeps this planet habitable for all of us. It's the way that the planet adjusts and keeps it habitable, so we can count on this planet being the way it is in life for man. So again, we can't have all the assets of life without liabilities. I've come to believe now that no matter what decision or what you do on this earth, in this life now, there is positive benefits and there are negatives. I shocked someone recently when I said that I sometimes ask my clients, you know, give me the disadvantages of being healthy. A woman said, well, what do you mean, disadvantages? Well, I just love to be healthy. There are no disadvantages to being healthy. I said, yes, there are. I want you to think about the disadvantages. She had a lot of sicknesses of being healthy. She couldn't think of it. Well, let me give you just a few. When you're healthy, nobody feels sorry for you. When you're healthy, people expect you to do more than your share. Get out there and help out. Don't sit on your rear there. You're healthy. Get up there and do things. There are disadvantages for being healthy. Of course there are. And there are advantages to being sick. Call it secondary gain in psychology. A secondary gain. Because, you know, you're sick. Well, you get pushed around. You get the free tag on park in the handicap zone and this and that. You get all kinds of benefits for being sick. And there are negatives to being healthy. So, yes, everything has a positive and a negative. Uniformity. There, in nature, there's an inexorable law that is absolutely practical and useful. And it's just the way it is. We can count on it. Now, think, if every time a Christian were to get in trouble, and you're saying, well, God could save me. God has to suspend some of these laws every time for us. He's got to suspend the whirl of the wind and the tornado, the whirl of the wind and the hurricane. He's got to suspend all this. We get the benefits of it. We have to accept the liabilities of it. Can God protect us? Of course he can. Will he protect us? Sometimes he will. And I've seen sometimes that he doesn't. But if we ask God to just say, hey, God, we want you to protect us every time, you know? I mean, I drive a little too fast, but I want you to put the brakes on, send a few angels and shove the car back here. Stop the car faster than it would ordinarily stop. I want you to do these things. I want you to suspend the laws of nature. Now, I want you to picture this. Picture a football player running down the sideline. He's running. Okay. Now, if you're the offensive team and you got the ball, wouldn't it be wonderful? You're running, you're trying to get, where do you want to go? You're trying to get across that goal line, right? There's that goal line. If you have to break the plane, they used to say in football, you break the plane of the goal line. Wouldn't it be wonderful if that goal line could just move your way as you're running toward it? It's coming, it's moving your way, getting closer so that you don't have to go as far. And these guys are trying to tackle you, but the goal line is coming. And you just one little swim, but the goal line's moving. And you made it across. You moved the goal line toward you. Isn't that wonderful? Of course, if you're on the defense, I'm trying to stop this guy. It would be great if that goal line keeps moving back. He's trying to get there, but it's moving. We got a chance to tackle him. The goal line moved back a few yards. We got him before he got there. But think about what the game of football would be like if there was a movable goal line. What would it be like? It wouldn't even be the game. The whole point of the game of football is that you got a stable goal line that you can go over. You can count on it being stable. You can count on the inexorable part of that it's there. It's not going to move backward, and it's not going to move forward. It's going to be where it is. So we can see that the rigidity of the goal line is what the whole game of football is about. And in the business of life, we can count on these things of nature that are absolute. What would the universe be like if nature were erratic? If you couldn't count, I mean, if, you know, it just started and it would stop, and you couldn't count on it being this way, gravity, you know, all of a sudden somebody was going to fall, but the gravity now suspended. Of course, all of us are bumping our heads on the ceiling, but the baby wouldn't fall to the earth. And so, you know, we have all that. The truck that crashed over the bridge couldn't fall because, you know, the gravity was suspended, but the rest of us are floating in the air. You know, you can't count on anything. How would that be? Nature erratic, capricious? What kind of world would it be if the law of gravitation operated one moment and didn't operate the next? It would be a world of chaos. So there we are. We have the laws of God. They are worth it. People would say, If you took it away so that you made the game easy and it would move towards you every time you had the ball and you could always make a touchdown, it would be no game at all. It would be no challenge to the game. There would be no workout. You don't even have to train. You don't have, because the goal line is going to come your way. Robert Browning once said, when he was talking about life, he said this: all's love, yet all's law. We have the mystery of the beneficence of the inexorable law of God. Gravity, wind, power, things that we can count on in nature. The sunlight is warm, or this. Now, one of the things that, here's nature itself, these laws, the inexorable laws, have both benefits and they have liabilities. They often can cause suffering for people. You fall, you hurt yourself. I ask you not to fall. You can fall and hit your head and hurt yourself really badly. Put yourself in the hospital, break a hip. One of the things that causes a lot of sufferings is the fact that humans are interactive. You could probably save yourself from a lot of crime if you just went to a remote area and lived all by yourself and there was not another human being within 3,000 miles of you. You know, I mean, if you could just get somewhere and nobody else was around, you could save yourself from crime. Because, you know, a lot of suffering comes from the fact that even though we're all here, somebody goes mad. We've heard about a church back in Wisconsin some years ago where a man came to one of the churches of God with a gun. And during the middle of the service, somewhere, he pulls out his gun and shot the minister and shot several people in the church. Now, how do we stop that? Why did God let it happen? If we could just be away from people like that, we could never be around them, it would be good. But we take a chance every time we're around people, don't we? That somebody could hurt you. Absolutely. So someone will say, well, I'd just love to go, you know, I mean, think of the shootings in Columbine. Think of the shootings at Sandy Hook School in Connecticut and dozens of others where somebody goes mad and we have somebody hurting us. So if a person, in the same way with countries, you know, our nation is connected to other nations and this nation decides to start a war. Look at Israel over there next to the Gaza, and all of a sudden they're throwing bombs over at Israel. Well, if we could just separate from all these people, maybe we wouldn't have to run the risk of suffering from somebody else. But think of it, if you were all by yourself. There's a counterbalance. There are benefits to being around people, aren't there? The benefits. The very fact of our mutual interdependence is responsible for so much of our blessings as well as the sheer tragedy. Okay? Where would we be? Suppose you were isolated. Think of what you would miss. Think of the things you would miss. Yeah, you wouldn't have to worry about suffering, but look at the things you would miss. Your daily bread, clothes you wear, the furnace that you burn, the scientific discoveries, your iPhone. If you weren't around people that were doing things, every one of us does something to serve somebody else. So we get benefits from interaction and all of our connections with all these people. We call them in the world sometimes. But yes, even atheists and so on, they're out there making inventions that have benefited our lives. You drive your car, you wouldn't have a car if you had to make it yourself. There's no way in the world I could make that cell phone that I could buy for a few hundred dollars, or even less if you get it on, if you sign up forever on the AT&T plan. But there's no way I could do that. There's no way I can have that. I'm wearing a suit that somebody made. My shoes, somebody made. My underclothes, somebody made. I didn't make them. You didn't make yours, probably. So we buy them because somebody's making them. There's this interaction that benefits our lives. Yet we run the risk that somebody could go off the beam and hurt us. Somebody could go postal and come to one of the factories where all these things are made. You can't have it both ways. You can't have all the benefits of life and none of the liabilities of life. And there's God's impartiality. People ask why. Why should an earthquake hurt God's people? Why should an earthquake over here destroy God's church over there? Why? And you ever see what happened in the San Francisco earthquake? You see the church went down and the bar was still there? The churches all went down, and what was left is one of the bars is still there. How can you do that? How can an earthquake leave one of the bars where people got drunk and the churches where they worshiped went down? We ask why. Wouldn't it be a better universe for sure if we could be sure that virtue would reap its appropriate reward, and everybody who's doing evil would just get suffering? Well, let's be sure we understand what the New Testament says, what the gospel says, and what it does not say. If you read the Bible, it does not say that if a man follows Christ, his business will not go bankrupt. Does it say that? Does it say in the Bible, the New Testament, it does not suggest that if two parents believe sincerely in God, death will not rob them of a child. It does not say or hold out the promise that if you are a religious person, there will always be supernatural interventions to lift you out of every tight corner, every problem, every issue. Does it say that? Let me read you a passage that Jesus told. And when he was on the earth, he gave this little analogy. It's in the book of Matthew, chapter 7, dropping down to verse 24. Now, Jesus is talking, you know, this is the Sermon on the Mount. He gives a lot of statements and teachings. And this is what he says in Matthew 7, verse 24. But I want you to read it. Let's read it with me. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And listen, and the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against that house. And yet it did not fall, for it had been founded on the rock. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. Verse 27, the rain fell, the floods came, the winds blew and slammed against that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. Do you get what Jesus Christ is saying here? The righteous man builds his house. The one who doesn't believe Jesus builds it on sand, the righteous man. But guess what happens to both houses? The rain fell, the floods came, the winds blew on both houses equally. God didn't say, okay, the rains fell and the floods came on the wicked man's house, the one who doesn't believe Jesus, but the sunshine and the gentle breezes and the little pitter-patter rain came on the one of the one that built his hands on the rock. No. You build your house on the rock because rains are coming, because floods may happen, because the wind will blow. Not because it won't blow. Yes. On both these lives, then, both the Christian and the unbeliever, the rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew, and they beat against the house. They beat against it. And we cry, why? Why would not the world be more of a just place if God's people got all the good and all the evil people got all the evil, the dessert, their just desserts? Wouldn't that be better? But think again. What would that mean if all the who believed in God got everything good, and all who didn't believe in God got all the misery and the punishment? Guess what would happen? It would be the end of righteousness for righteousness' sake. People would now begin to be righteous so they could be blessed. Just so, well, I want to be like you. You got. Let me do this. I'll change. I'll go from Sunday to Saturday. I'll go from pork to beef. I'll go from this to that. I'll do this thing. Yeah, absolutely. I'll go from Christmas to Feast Tabernacles. I'll go. Sure, I will. Oh yeah. Here I am. I will. Absolutely. I want to do this because I'm going to be blessed. If I get all this, I'll be blessed. Yes. What would be? It would be the ruin of God's religion and true character building. Far better that troubles should come and darkness descend and winds blow and the rains come than that the righteousness should be sought for any other reason except for righteousness for its own sake. We'll talk more about the issue of suffering and what the Bible says, what I think common sense sees in us next week.